Today's Teisho will be on Case 29 in the Mumonkan, The Sixth Ancestors, Your Mind Moves. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag was moving, the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor said, "It is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is your mind that moves." The two monks were awestruck. Mumon's comment, "It is not the mind, it is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves." How do you see the ancestor? If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The ancestor could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace. Mumon's verse, "Wind, flag, mind moving, all equally to blame. Only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking." I wonder if you've had this experience. About a week ago, I had been working very hard, and I had to get away, and so I was with my wife Barbara and my father, my 90-year-old father-in-law, Jack. And we went out to a place called the Long Valley. And it's here in New Jersey, but you'd never know it. It's quite an amazing place. If you go on Route 78 and you take the turnoff for I can't remember the turnoff right now. But maybe it'll come to me. But I was going north on 78, or west on 78. And there's this turn off. And it was quite a surprise because after turning off 78 and driving for possibly 15 or 20 miles, we came to an intersection. And then according to my directions, we took a left. And there's an area in New Jersey called the Long Valley. It's also next to a place called German Valley. And it was like being transported to another place. It was really quite amazing. Because I live in Union County and work in Middlesex County. And my life is probably very much like yours. I'm used to being in very long lines of traffic. I'm used to crowds. This is a high density area. And when we got on 78 and took this drive, got to the Long Valley, it was like being transported back into another time, and it was really like being in another state. because there were these really large farms that have been protected by state laws that have protected agricultural land. And the farms were quite huge, hundreds and hundreds of acres. And they followed a valley, and the valley, in the center of the valley, there was a river. And across the road, over the river, there was a mountain chain. So there's a big mountain that runs the whole way parallel with the road, and there's a river. And it was just extraordinary because I felt like I was in Montana or Eastern Washington State. The turnoff is for Old Wick. And anyway, it was just the most amazing experience. I had been to a small part of that, but I'd never really gone the whole distance down the long valley. And there were these big farms, and people had raised all kinds of things. There were orchards, and there were fields full of corn. And the mountains were still green a couple of weeks ago or a week ago. And basically the river was quite lovely. We stopped and looked at the water. And there were many birds there. It was quite remarkable. If you're a bird fan, there were a number of grebes, in case you're a fan of grebes. There, if you're a bird watcher, that's quite a find here in New Jersey. They look a little bit like a loon, if you know anything about birds, but they have a red head. And so my wife, who is a bird person, spotted them right away, and we had to pull over and look at the grebes. And then we noticed that there were other kinds of birds there too. There was some bird called a kingfisher. And a kingfisher is a bird with a big blue head and a small body. And it's about the size of a woodpecker, maybe a little smaller than a crow. And it eats fish. And so it dove down into the water. We saw kingfishers diving into the water, and they have a sound a little bit like a woodpecker. They're not related to woodpeckers, but it's another one of those sounds. So there were the grebes with their red heads, and there were the kingfishers going and diving down into the water. And we saw one kingfisher, and then we saw another kingfisher, and then we saw another kingfisher. And then up in the trees, there was, I spotted a great gray heron. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these, but they live in New Jersey, and they're quite majestic. They can be 6 feet tall. I'm not kidding. You sometimes see a smaller heron, the night heron, but this heron can be like 5 feet tall, 6 feet tall. In fact, we have a pond behind our house. We made a little pond for fish, and that we share with our neighbors. Our neighbors have a pond, and we have a pond, and our neighbors made a little stream that flows from their pond into our pond, and then there's a artificial system that pumps the water back down this little artificial waterfall. And there's fish in the pond. And one day I got up, and there was a great gray heron in the backyard eating all the fish in the pond. And I was thrilled, actually, because they're majestic. They're so beautiful. And in fact, this sounds rather callous, but we really have too many fish in our pond. So I was happy to see the bird eat some of them. And it had, of course, it had gone for the biggest ones. So it when I looked, it had this koi in its mouth, and it was trying to eat it, but it was huge, And my neighbors were quite upset, and now we have a plastic heron, that it actually scares away the herons. You have to keep moving it around, but it seems to work. You know? But the thing is, you know, I was so struck when we were on this river in the Long Valley because I kept seeing heron after heron after heron. And it was just the most remarkable thing. You know, it was like this beautiful, it was just really remarkable. You know, this is like in the way New Jersey used to look 100 years ago. New Jersey, I think it still says on the license plates, the Garden State, you know. And that must baffle people, you know. Because, you know, you think, where are the gardens, you know? But actually, 100 years ago, this place was really quite amazing. You know, New Jersey was just a handful of cities and a bunch of farms. That was New Jersey. And this was like old New Jersey, because there were these little towns that were hundreds of years old, these big farms, and this pristine, pristine river, you know, really like a stream. But all of this animal life, you know, really quite remarkable. And, you know, just sitting there, walking along the water, I felt this deep sense of peace, you know, deep sense of peace. It was just a wonderful afternoon for me. But on the other hand, my companions weren't happy particularly. My father-in-law was really pretty bored. You know, he has a little, he has something called a rascal, which is an electric cart. So we can put it in the car. It's actually quite, it's about 100 pounds. So you can lift it up, put it in the back seat of a car or in the trunk of a car and take it out. And there's a seat you can attach and it has an electric battery. And the battery really will run for like 10 miles. It's really quite wonderful. So we'd brought the rascal and Jack was in it. And Jack is a very nice man, but he wasn't happy. He was bored. And I said something like, isn't this beautiful? Isn't this a beautiful area or something? Or aren't these farms beautiful? And he said something like, yeah, he said, if you like farms, you know. And I could see he was impatient. You know, he really was bored. And my wife Barbara had a lot of troubles. You know, a lot of problems going on in her life. Some of them with her work, and so she couldn't really relax. You know, and I thought that's interesting. It's really interesting. I mean, I've been in the same situation Barbara's been in. You know, sometimes we've been somewhere and I have problems with my work, you know, too. And I might be really like unable to enjoy the surroundings because I'm haunted by my problems, you know. But I was lucky on this day, you know. I had a clear mind, and everything was so beautiful and alive for me. But I thought it was interesting because, you know, what is it that makes something, a moment like that, really happen? You know, what is it that makes a moment like that really happen? You know, everybody has moments like that. You don't have to drive out to the Long Valley. You know, you could be just going, a couple of you went up into the mountains last week, and I was so happy about that. Probably. You had some wonderful experiences, or I hope you did, you probably saw a lot of beautiful country. But I don't know if you really enjoyed it or not, and it's difficult to control that, right? I mean, sometimes it's like magic, you know, and it doesn't have to be up in the mountains. It doesn't have to be, but sometimes. everything just seems to have a special quality. And it's like magic. It's hard to describe it, right? I mean, everything can be right, but it isn't there, you know? So you could say, oh, the Long Valley sounds interesting, you know? You could drive out there and just doesn't click, you know? But we all have these moments where everything seems to be perfect in some kind of way we can't really define, you know? And it often happens unexpectedly, where there's just this sort of like natural perfection to things. And it's mysterious why it happens. You know, why for me, that trip was really quite wonderful. Being by that river was really quite wonderful. For my wife, not so wonderful. For my father-in-law, terrible, right? Or boring, I guess. As I say, we all have these experiences, and they don't necessarily happen in such a beautiful place. Years ago, I used to work in a place where I used to work at the University of Washington in an office there, and I didn't really have an office. I actually had something that was really like a cubicle, you know. This was my first administrative job after I finished my dissertation, and I was hired to run a small program for minority students by the English department. Hired me to run this program, and so I didn't get an office, but I got a cubicle in a group of offices. And at this time, there was a guy in our Zen group named Dick Dietrich, and Dick Dietrich was a magazine editor. He had built up a magazine very successfully in Seattle and sold it later for a pretty good amount of money. And he sort of looked down on me a little bit, because he thought I was I don't know how to put it. He thought I was going to graduate school in English literature. I didn't have my act together, he thought, and he had this idea that I probably got up at noon and read some nice books and went to these classes and discussed literature with my teachers, which wasn't at all the truth, you know. But he always used to say, well, when you get a real job, you know, when you get a real job, you'll know. So anyway, we were working together on our Sangha newsletter. We had a newsletter that we produced once a month, and it had teishos from Genki Roshi and news of our group and things that people had written. Dick and I were working on this project together. One day he came to my office, and he was stunned by how noisy and chaotic it was. Because I had this cubicle in this group of offices, and you know, there was a secretary at the main desk, and people would be coming in and out all day long. And other teachers were meeting with their students in some of the meeting areas, and my cubicle was right there, in that room, and the place was insane sometimes. Anyway, Dick came to meet me in my cubicle, and he was so frustrated. He said, "I couldn't get any work done here." He said, "This is like a madhouse." After that, he never said, "When you have a real job again," you know, he never said that to me, because he realized where I did have a job, you know, and I worked very hard, and it was in a crazy place, you know. But I can remember one day after Sesshin, being at my desk, and suddenly, you know, it was the usual craziness, but everything became, it was like everything You know, if you ever watch, or if you're ever watching a movie on TV, and there's like a, you know, deafening sound, you know, coming from the television, you know, like maybe it's Gladiator or something like that, and you just turn the sound down, you know, you just take the volume down, it has an interesting effect, especially if you make it quiet, you know. So there's this roar coming off of the you know, movie, and then you take it down to nothing, and it's a very strange sensation, because it's like suddenly, even though there's a lot of action on the screen, it's all very still somehow, right? It's like in the midst of all this motion, there's a kind of stillness, you know, in the midst of it. Or another way to put it is, all this motion is happening in the midst of a bigger stillness. It was like that in my office. I haven't ever forgotten this moment, because it was very powerful, you know. I mean, my office was so chaotic, it was so noisy, people were coming in and out, you know. And I remember it was as though I had turned the volume down. And even though everybody was running around, there was this extraordinary stillness. You know? And I realized, you know, it's not in the circumstances, you know, or it may not be in the circumstances. There's something about this. At that moment, I felt this a kind of like unity. Right? There's a kind of a unity. Really remarkable, really, really beautiful and special. And it was the same kind of feeling I got when I was on the river in the Long Valley, you know, different circumstances, but that same feeling, you know, that same feeling. If you do Zazen, of course, as you all do, you know what this is like in another, you know, context. Because you know, sometimes you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you're haunted by all the events of your day or of your week. We all have things nagging away at us and troubling us. But sometimes when we sit down on the cushion, it's like a kind of, there's a deep, like connectedness. And everything, it's like being a fish and discovering that you're in water. You know, it's like that. It's like being, if you were a fish, you wouldn't normally notice the water, right? You'd notice the plants, and you'd notice the other fish, especially the fish that were trying to eat you. And you might notice the little bits of food that were floating around in the water. But you wouldn't normally notice the water. But sometimes when we're sitting on the cushion, it's like we notice the water. It's like it's like we're in something. We're in something. But we don't know what it is. Normally, it doesn't seem to be there, you know. And I think it's fascinating that we can't always make it happen, you know. So, people come here for their first lessons in Zazen, and some people struggle and they don't come back. Some people do struggle and come back, but that's more rare. But sometimes people have a really beautiful samadhi experience, you know, beautiful. So they sit down on the cushion and somehow they have that deep sense of connection, you know. And it's such a beautiful feeling, right? That safety, well-being, you know. And it's just magical. And then you know, they get off the cushion and they go home and they think, oh, this Zen is wonderful. they come back the next week and they sit down on the cushion and it doesn't happen. You know, I think that's quite interesting. But I think the reason for this is that I don't think it's a matter, you know, if people say, you can try many different schemes to make this happen. You know? So for example, you could arrange a zendo at your home where you had the candles and the incense and you drew the curtains. Maybe you had a wonderful relaxing experience when you were using a certain kind of incense. So you could buy the same incense. You know. This is a little bit like, I've heard that athletes, especially like ball players, are very superstitious. You know, they if they have a run of like hits, if you're you have a good hit, you hit the ball as a batter, and then the next time you're up to bat, you hit the ball as a batter. Athletes really pay attention to that. And so they make a little ritual. So if they hit the ball, you know, if they did certain things before they hit the ball, they try to repeat those things, you know. So if they wash their hands before coming out of the dugout, or before going up to bat, if they rinse their hands, and then they hit the ball and it sailed out, they rinse their hands again. You know, if they scratched their shoulder, you know, they'll scratch their shoulder again. You know, this is quite well known that baseball players become very obsessive about repeating these, you know, things that are supposed to bring them luck. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. And I think this is quite important, you know, for. Quite important, and it's like that sense of connection is worth so much. It's so precious, and it's so important in our lives. People spend really like millions of dollars to get it, you know. So people go to exotic locations. You know, you might spend thousands of dollars to go to Hawaii. You might spend, you know, thousands of dollars to go to, you know, you name the place. And you get there, and actually, you might not be happy. You know, it's very interesting. I mean, it might be, it's difficult sometimes to be unhappy in a place like Hawaii, but people manage to do it all the time. You know, people who live in Hawaii must be unhappy sometime, right? We go there, and it's everything we ask for, right? Beautiful sun. Beautiful sea, trees blowing in the wind. But actually, you know, people in Honolulu can be quite unhappy. They have a high crime rate, and they have their problems. So there's something about this experience which is hard to get at, but it's quite important. You know? I don't think that, my personal feeling is that the conscious mind can't really have that experience, you know. The mind that we have, which is the mind that uses words and ideas and that makes plans and that has expectations and fears and desires and so on, I don't think that mind ever manages to experience that unity. I really think it's like a contradiction in terms, you know. If you think about it, when we use language, when we have expectations and so on, we're really creating a kind of split in the fundamental nature of things. You know, there's the moment is perfect, And then as soon as you say it's perfect, you begin to go, well, what is it about it that's perfect? And you begin to do just what I'm doing in this teshu. You say, well, what is it that makes it perfect? Is it the trees? Well, no, I don't think it's the trees. Is it the water? Well, maybe, but that's not all, you know. It's hard to put our fingers on what makes it so quote-unquote perfect, you know. And as soon as we start to look, I think it begins to disappear, begins to elude us, you know. This is a big problem, you know. When I was a college student, one of the things I used to do on the weekends was go to the museum. I lived near Washington, D.C., and I used to go to the National Gallery because in Washington, D.C., all the galleries are free. So when I was in college, I had minus money. I had negative money. But one of the things I could always do was go into D.C. with my friend Larry Sullivan, and we could go to the museums for free all day. And I would walk through the museums and I would look at these beautiful paintings, you know, and I just loved them. It was one of the most pleasant things I did at that time in my life. And painting after painting just gave me the deepest sense of pleasure and I guess you could say connectedness. So at one point in my education, I decided to take an art history class. And you know, it's interesting, I could never get better than a B in art history. Yeah. I took these courses and I looked at these beautiful paintings, and the professors all had a system for talking about the paintings. I remember one professor always used to say he'd project a picture on the screen, and then he'd take his pointer and he'd say the eye starts here and moves here, you know. And I'd always think, well, my eye doesn't do that, or does it? You know, really? The eye starts here and moves here. This was art theory. The eye starts at the left corner of the painting and moves upward, you know, and to the right. And so all paintings had to be quote-unquote read in this way. And of course, this baffled me because that wasn't how I experienced paintings. And of course, they wanted us to interpret the paintings just like you would interpret a poem. So I had to say what the painting means. And even though I could do this with poetry, it bothered me very much to do this with art, you know, with works of visual art. Because it was taking something away from the experience, you know. Maybe I was gaining something too. I was learning how to talk about art in a discursive, art historical and analytical way. That's true. But I was also losing something, which was that sense of connectedness I got from the paintings, you know. So my feeling is that, you know, even though it's not a crime to study art history, there's another way of experiencing the world. And if what we're after is that sense of like connectedness or unity, when we try to analyze or explain, what we actually do is we create a kind of fragmentation, and then we keep trying to fix it. But the more we think, or the more we talk, or the more we analyze, the farther that kind of fundamental, implicit unity recedes from view. You know? So, you know, one way to understand Zazen is that it's really about learning how to let go of that discriminating mind, that the conscious mind that analyzes using words and ideas. And it's as though, you know, we can only experience reality sort of like by looking over our shoulder very quickly, you know. It's like you have to come at it indirectly. And you sort of have to have a kind of floating, aimless mind. And indeed, the best thing is to have a thoughtless mind. And when you're in that sort of floating, aimless, thoughtless state, that there's always present, I think, a kind of implicit unity. But it's not accessible to the conscious mind. It's always, the conscious mind always starts by cutting it in two. And so, you know, this would explain why it's so hard, you know, to have those kinds of deep experiences of connectedness. And we experience this in many different aspects of our lives. So, you know, for example, when you first get married, or before you get married, you meet somebody you might find quite exciting, you know. And you meet that person and, you know, somehow there's something about them which is really quite wonderful and special, unusual. And you want maybe to be with that person all the time, you know, and it's really quite wonderful, that moment in one's life, you know, where you're simply enjoying the pure presence of somebody else. In Buddhism, we have a word for that, you know, that when the mind is floating freely, without any kind of an objective, and it has no agendas or expectations, it's not using language or analyzing, you experience this kind of implicit unity. No matter where you are, you know, it could be in the middle of a busy city, it could be in a beautiful country spot, you know, but actually that unity is always there, and when it is, you know, we experience like the pure presence of the world, and in Buddhism the word for that is tathata, T-A-T-H-A-T-A. So like the Buddha is called the Tathagata. Well, this is the same word. Basically, this word is the same as that. It means like, thus come, pure thusness, pure presentness. And when I think we first fall in love, we are quite taken by the pure presentness of the other person, and it's a beautiful experience precisely because it's not analyzed, it can't even, you know, if you say, well, how do you feel about him? Or how do you feel? Oh, I love him. But then you think, well, what does that really mean? And of course, as soon as you ask that question, love becomes a very complex issue, right? But what you're really enjoying, I think, is this experience of tathata, pure thusness, pure presence. And it's magical, too, just like being in a in the long valley of New Jersey on a sunny September afternoon. You know, but then of course everything gets complicated, and it has to, right? I mean, first of all, usually people have expectations of other people in their relationships, right? It's possible to enjoy the object of your possible to enjoy the presence of this other person, but one day, you know, they're going to do something that you don't enjoy or you don't like, or that baffles you or that troubles you, and the pure presence disappears, and then you might have an unhappy time. You know, this happens to everybody, actually, who has any kind of a relationship, you know. And it can become very confusing, right? It becomes very confusing because, what made that experience so magical can disappear. And of course, people try to cope with this with their discriminating mind. You know, it is important to try to talk things through. We have to communicate. Those things are essential, you know. But you know, actually, people can take many can go through many sessions of counseling where they talk it all through, and the magic is still gone. And I think it goes away because there needs to be space for this other kind of experience. You know, I've been married for 33 years, and it wasn't all happy, I must say. Some of it was happy, but some of it was challenging. And it helped me a great deal to realize that I would never really understand my wife. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, I don't think anybody can really be understood. And I think that when we try to understand people, maybe we're not engaging with them in the best way possible. You know, sometimes when I'm in the presence of my wife, I'm just happy to be in her presence, you know? And in fact, I enjoy that quite a bit. You know, and it doesn't really require any effort of understanding on my part. You know, I could say, well, we're very different. You know, you like this, I like that, you know. This is the case, this is not the case, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, we can be different in all kinds of ways. We can disagree, as we've discovered, in all kinds of ways. But, it's a pure joy sometimes just to be with her, you know, and for no reason at all. Just the pure presence of this person could be very wonderful. And I think that is really why, you know, we've been together for 30 years, because, you know, quite apart from our differences, there's this, we're able somehow to go back to just that kind of a thing, you know, that kind of a relationship where I'm not really expecting anything. I don't have an opinion. You know, I'm just glad to be there, you know. I think that's so important, you know. We can have this, we can't have it all the time, you know. When we go to our jobs, we have problems we have to deal with. We have to use our discriminating mind. That's what we've been hired for, right? You don't get a check for sitting calmly and doing nothing, you know. If you find that job, let me know, you know. But generally speaking, we're paid for our ability to cut the fabric of reality in multiple pieces, right, in some different way. But nevertheless, these moments where suddenly you're simply present with what is, these are, I think, really the best moments of life. You know, they're really the most important. They really are life itself, you know, and they are greatly energizing and sustaining. What does this have to do with the koan? The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, the other said the mind moved. Well, this is a discriminating mind, right? This is the mind that cuts in two. Does it move or doesn't it move? You know, this is what happened to me in art history class, right? You know, I just thought it was a beautiful painting, you know? And then I began to think, well, what is beautiful, right? And then I began to think, well, where does the eye go? And what is the artist trying to say? You know, maybe he just painted it, you know? I mean, I am an English professor, and when people say stuff like that, it drives me crazy, right? You know, you teach poetry, and When I was a student, undergraduate, I was taking a course with a very famous English professor, and there was a guy in my class who was from, I can't remember, I think he was from Brazil. His name was Mr. Marino. And he didn't understand, he was a business major, and he was taking this poetry course because he wanted a little culture. He was like me in the art history class, right? So anyway, we'd be reading this poem, and Mr. Marino would stick up his hand, and he'd go, ah, the way he uses words, it's so beautiful, you know. And everybody would just think, what a dope, right? You know, what a dope. And he'd do it all the time, and the professor would be so nice. He'd go, yes, it is quite beautiful. So it was stupid, right? But you know, actually, that stupidity is very important, you know. What he really meant was there's something, he really said, there's something about this poem I can enjoy without analyzing it, you know. And maybe that's why he kept sticking up his hand. Maybe this was like an act of resistance, you know, because we were tearing it to pieces, you know. You know, that often happens, you know, you take something and you tear it to pieces, and then you think, well, this guy's an idiot, this poet's an idiot, you know. I'm so much smarter than this poet, you know. But of course, we forgot why we read poetry. Keats has this wonderful line. He says that sometimes we can be, he says, teased out of thought. You know, teased out of thought. Keats says sometimes things are so beautiful that they stop us in our tracks, and we just become thoughtless. Right? Thoughtless. And those moments are really like eternal. You know, they're really precious. They're eternal. Really. So these two monks are arguing about whether the flag moves or not. And anyway, Wei Neng is walking by, the sixth ancestor of Zen. He's walking by, and he hears these two guys. And he says, you know, he says, it's not the flag that's moving, it's not the wind that's moving, it's your mind. And they don't know what the hell this means, right? They're teased out of thought, you know. And their minds are just stunned, right? And it says they were dumbfounded, they were awestruck. It's translated here as awestruck. They were dumbfounded, right? Now, you know, Mumon comes by later, and he says, it's not the wind, it's not the flag, and it's not the mind. What he means is that's just another concept, right? Wei Neng could have said anything. He could have said, your pants are on fire, you know? He just had to stop their minds. And as soon as their minds stopped, that implicit, that unity, which is always there, reappeared, right? As soon as you open your mouth, now we have to open, my mouth is wide open right now, you know? But nevertheless, it's like underneath all of this disorder, there's an underlying order. Underneath, it's like turning down the sound, you know. It's like there's a deeper silence that surrounds all this chaos, you know. Mumon's verse, wind, flag, mind, moving. All equally to blame. In other words, you can't fall, and it's so difficult, it's so easy to say this, right? It's so easy to say this. But you can't fall out of this unity. Only the small mind thinks you can fall out. You know, it's always present. You can say, well, you know, tell it to the guy with the pink slip. You know, tell it to the person with cancer. And I understand that, you know. But nevertheless, it's always there. You know, it's always there. There's nothing we can do to put it there. It's always already there. Even to be, you know, it's interesting. Even to feel separate and alienated already requires a kind of deeper unity. You know, have you ever thought of that? Even to have an argument with somebody, you already have to like speak their language. You have to share a whole world with them. You know, that's a little philosophical, if you're having an argument with somebody, you must already care enough to have an argument. You know what I mean? So there's got to be something deeper there already. And there's always something deeper there, you know, always something deeper than we know. So, The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor said, "It's not the wind that moves. It's not the flag that moves. It's your mind that moves." The two monks were dumbfounded. So I hope you have the chance to be dumbfounded very soon. If you weren't this morning, just keep sitting, you know. It's the most beautiful experience. It's really, I'll wrap it up. But, you know, I've talked about this before, but about a century ago, some very liberal Americans tried to have what they called the, and British people too, tried to have what they called the World Parliament of Religions. The people wanted to get religious teachers from all over the world to come and talk about their different religions, which is really a wonderful thing, right? So they invited, Islamic scholars and Sufi mystics and Indian philosophers and pandits and so on, gurus. And they also invited a Zen monk named Soyin Shaku. And apparently the Indian teacher was a big hit, you know. He had many interesting ideas that people enjoyed quite a bit. And they were fascinated with Vedanta philosophy and so on, which is, you know, quite close to Zen, actually. But this yogi's style was to lay it all out, and it was very accessible to a Western audience. And Soyin Shaku got up and he said, "You know, the problem with modern people is they don't know how to be dumbfounded." And everybody laughed. They thought he didn't know English very well, you know. But he was making such an important point. You know, if we feel so homeless sometimes and so lost, and as Hakuin says, we're like a person standing in water complaining about thirst. But we feel that way because we're using the wrong mind. You know, right here, there's always this big unity. This indestructible unity, but the little mind can't see it. So today we came together to be dumbfounded, and I wish you many moments of that stupidity.